This is Rob Jacobson reading the Monday, July 14, 2025 edition of the News Gazette. We'll start with the headline article on page 1 entitled, She's All Business, Ford County Fair Queen Charlie Ulrich Already Putting Artistic Talents to Use. Don't be surprised if Charlie Ulrich is operating her own business one day after college. She has the creativity and the genes for it. The 18-year-old Paxton Buckley Loda High School grad, recently crowned Miss Ford County Fair, already has her own small greeting cards business, Bella by Char. Ulrich, who has operated the business since her junior year in high school, draws her card creations on an iPad and prints them out. They are for sale in a few area stores. She also sells custom cards. I have a lot of fun doing it, she said. I'm in 4 or 5 stores. That keeps me busy. Ulrich, who served as PBL's correspondent for the News Gazette's High School Confidential in 2024-25, said the artistic ability runs in the family. Ever since I can remember, I have drawn, she said, noting that her mother personalizes sports memorabilia for individuals and teams by drawing names and logos. An uncle who lives in Colorado is a children's book illustrator. Ulrich recently got into photography and said she is likely to transfer her business interest more into that realm and away from the greeting card line. While inheriting her artistic ability from her family, the same might be said of her entrepreneurial interest. Her grandfather, Dan Day, owns Dan Day Drainage in Gibson City. Ulrich is a daughter of Chuck and Sarah Ulrich. A fair queen, she succeeds Kate Wilson. Other fair queen contestants were Natalie Aberley, 17, of Gibson City, a daughter of Randy and Darla Aberley. Aubrey Sawyer, 18, of Paxton, a daughter of Joe and Hillary Sawyer. And Kylie Williams, 16, of Paxton, a daughter of William and Chelsea Williams. Miss Ford County Fair Director Kristen Wyatt said all 4 pageant contestants represented themselves well. The contestants were judged on confidence, interviews, their delivery in a speech, and how they carried themselves through the evening gown portion. Wyatt, a teacher at PBL High School, said she knows Ulrich from her days as a student. She was a member of Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America, serving as president, was active in student council, and the CEO program at the high school. Charlie was definitely a kiddo who not only wanted to interact with her fellow students, but with the community as well, Wyatt said. At PBL, Ulrich played softball and volleyball, but had to give up the latter sport when she tore her ACL. It was literally the worst experience of my life, she said. Volleyball was my favorite sport. It worked out for the best because I could focus on my businesses. Ulrich also enjoys collegiate baseball. Her boyfriend, Ty Cribbett of Gibson City, is a member of the Millikan University baseball team. I spend a lot of time with family and my dogs, 2 golden doodles who keep me busy. I love being at Lake of the Ozarks. That's my happy place. We were just there last weekend. I love jet skiing. In addition to her own businesses, Ulrich works at M2 Prom in Champaign and plans to continue to work there through college. She will attend Parkland College in the fall, majoring in communications, and said she will continue with her business on the side and wants to lean into photography. I'm not sure what I want to do career-wise, whether in the marketing world or the sports world, Ulrich said. I really enjoy sports photography. I'm always open to new pathways and things to learn. Evidence of that was her involvement with the CEO program that included students from PBL, Fisher, and Gibson City, Melvin Sibley. It takes some commitment to participate. Classes start at 7 a.m. The program is designed to complement area economic development efforts. Training, materials, content, and mentoring, as well as guidance for CEO programs, are provided by the Effingham-based Midland Institute for Entrepreneurship. Ulrich said the class not only gave her more business knowledge, it also helped her make new connections. As Ford County Fair Queen, Ulrich will compete in January for the title of Miss Illinois County Fair. She will also represent Ford County at other area county fairs. In the other front page article of the paper today, a state news entitled Illinois Department of Public Health Lead Testing Mandated in Some Area Zip Codes. The Illinois Department of Public Health has added 180 zip codes, including some in Champaign and Piatt counties, to the list of areas where it is mandatory to test children for lead exposure. The list now includes over 1,350 high-risk zip codes, and state officials said all remaining zip codes in Illinois will be added by this time next year to enact universal testing across the state. There is no safe level of lead in the blood, said Dr. Samir Vohra, director of the state health agency. Early detection and intervention are critical tools to help protect Illinois' kids from the serious health and developmental challenges caused from lead exposure. Any child living in a high-risk zip code must be tested automatically at 12 and 24 months, state officials said. This is done through the child's health care provider, said health agency spokesman Mike Claffey. Additionally, the state requires that all children 6 and younger be evaluated for lead exposure through a questionnaire administered by a health care provider, and those who fall under other risk categories specified in the survey must also be tested. Under current Illinois law, blood tests that come back with lead levels in excess of 3.5 micrograms per deciliter require a public health intervention, state officials said. This includes a home inspection to determine the source of the lead contamination. If lead is found, the inspector works with the homeowner to remove the sources of lead. In addition, a public health nurse will visit and educate the family on ways to protect children from the harmful effects of lead. Claffey told the News Gazette that the nurse will follow the child's case until their blood lead level is under that 3.5 threshold, and the inspector will keep track of the home where exposure occurred until it is remediated and certified as safe by testing. According to a report from the state, 8,276 children from its Champaign region were tested for lead exposure in 2023 via capillary blood draw, with 243 children having levels higher than the 3.5 threshold, and 151 having levels of more than 5 micrograms or more. The region includes Champaign, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, and Shelby counties. A list of all high-risk zip codes and information on lead poisoning can be found at dph.illinois.gov. State officials said that high-risk areas are determined by an algorithm that considers a variety of different risk factors. We would note that these zip codes have not been chosen based on lead in water, Claffey said. Lead in paint, paint chips, dust, and soil accounts for the vast majority of lead exposures. Moving on to Jim Dye's opinion column, entitled Ex-Lawmaker Considering Another Stint Now That He's Free. It's time to once again dive into another round of quick takes on the people, places, and events that were being talked about over the past week. Comeback Kid. Former federal prison inmate and one-time Democratic U.S. Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. is getting closer and closer to running again for Congress. Politico's Shia Kapos reports that Jackson is considering joining the field of candidates competing for the Democratic Party's nomination to succeed U.S. Representative Robin Kelly. She opted to give up her House seat and run for the U.S. Senate seat, being vacated by retiring Democrat Richard Durbin. The 60-year-old Jackson served in the U.S. House for 17 years before he was forced out of office in connection with the theft of campaign funds he used for personal purchases. Jackson served 2 years in prison. Recently, he's been hosting a radio show. A handful of candidates already have announced they are running, and it will be a spirited primary. The winner of the Democratic nomination will win the November 2026 general election because the district was drawn to guarantee a Democrat wins. The district is mostly made up of Cook County, but it runs for miles down the Illinois border to include Vermilion County, Ford County, Champaign County, and Iroquois County. Long road ahead. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker recently announced that he's running for re-election in 2026 as an expected prelude to running for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in 2028. The presidential race is 3 years away, and that's good for Pritzker because he has a lot of ground to make up. News reports indicate the latest Emerson College polling data of Democratic primary voters rank Pritzker near the bottom with only 2% support. The names of 13 prominent Democrats were included in the poll. Undecided got 13%, and someone else tied Pritzker with 2%. The only candidates to do worse than Pritzker were his fellow Illinoisan, former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. Former Biden Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg came out on top with 16% support, former Vice President Kamala Harris 13%, and U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with 7%. One of Pritzker's major problems is his lack of name recognition, a problem most of the others also confront. His good fortune, however, is his great fortune. Once he starts spending millions of dollars from his multi-billion dollar personal wealth, his name recognition, if not his popularity, will skyrocket. Six figures? Well, not quite. But the annual pay hike, called an annual cost of living increase, approved by members of the Illinois House and Senate for themselves, will put them on the brink of being paid $100,000 a year. Specifically, it's $98,304. However, most legislators also receive cash stipends worth up to $30,000 annually for serving in various leadership roles: House Speaker, Senate President, party leadership posts, and chairman and ranking members of the scores of legislative committees. For all practical purposes, they're getting well over $100,000 per year. Their pay was bumped up from $72,906 to $89,675 in 2023 after they gave themselves a 23% pay raise. Now, thanks to 2 5% hikes in 2024 and 2025, they stand on the brink of $100,000 a year. Another beatdown. Editorial writers of the Wall Street Journal last week described the city of Chicago as a fiscal mess, one that will get worse if Governor J.B. Pritzker approves legislation that will boost pensions for firefighters and police officers. Chicago is drowning in pension debt, but you wouldn't know it from the machinations in Springfield. At the end of the recent legislative session, lawmakers pushed through a last-minute pension sweetener for Chicago police and firefighters that will add millions in new debt the city can't afford. The measure awaits Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature, the Wall Street Journal wrote. The journal noted that Chicago's public pensions are already the worst funded of all major U.S. cities, and its pension debt of $37 billion as of 2023 puts it in a deeper hole than 43 states. The editorial urged Pritzker to veto the pension increase. If he doesn't, the Wall Street Journal warned, he could pay a high price down the road. This is a test for Mr. Pritzker, who will have to defend Illinois' fiscal record if he runs for president. Does he want more spendthrift progressive governance on his resume, the journal asked. More corruption. 2 weeks ago, federal prosecutors recommended a 4.5-year prison term for one of the defendants, former Commonwealth Edison lobbyist John Hooker, convicted in the company's conspiracy to bribe former House Speaker Michael Madigan. Last week, they recommended 70-month sentences for former ComEd executive Anna Pramaggiore and former ComEd lobbyist and Madigan confidant Michael McClain. Prosecutors have not made a recommendation yet for the final co-defendant, ComEd lobbyist Jay Doherty. As CEO of ComEd and then CEO of Exelon Utilities, Promyajuri could have put an end to these crimes at any time. She had that power, federal prosecutors said in their sentencing memo. That's true, but probably a little harsh. Sure, ComEd paid off Madigan, as the jury found, but what was the alternative when they knew they would have received nothing if they followed the path of virtue? That's not to excuse bribery or Promyajuri's refusal to accept responsibility for her actions, but in this case, it's a thin line between paying bribes to win Madigan's favor or submitting to extortion to do the same. She'll be sentenced on July 21 and McLean on July 24. Madigan, who already has been sentenced, faces a 7.5-year sentence. Even more corruption. Former Chicago alderman Kerry Austin, facing a corruption trial, figured out how to beat the feds. She convinced U.S. Judge John Ness that she's too ill to go to trial, a finding that prompted the judge to dismiss the case against her. That's a tough way for any defendant to beat the rap. The judge found that Austin's chronic and worsening medical conditions, which include chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart ailments, and cancer, make the prospect of a jury trial an unacceptable risk to her health. The charges against Austin, who's 76, reflect the typical aldermanic thievery for which Chicago politicians are infamous. Facing charges of bribery and lying to the FBI, Austin was indicated along with her chief of staff, Chester Wilson. He faces trial later this year. That earlier paragraph says indicated, but I believe that's a typographical error and they meant that she was indicted along with her chief of staff, Chester Wilson. The government alleged that a developer provided improvements to Austin's home and investment property in exchange for her help in getting his construction project approved by the city council. Repeating myself, baseball fans who enjoy engaging and thoughtful discussions about the professional game should tune in to MLB Now, a program hosted by Brian Kinney and carried on the MLB channel. Even better, tape it and watch without commercials. The program bills itself as a show for the thinking fan, an oxymoron if there ever was one. Nonetheless, it is first rate. Another killer choice. It's that time again, another recommendation from Jim's pseudo-intellectual book club. But this choice is different from the usual. It's an in-depth look at the dark side of human nature provided by a former prosecutor who was marinated in the horrific acts of his fellow man. In The Book of Murder, A Prosecutor's Journey Through Love and Death, Matt Murphy introduces readers to pure evil, a quality too many people don't think about when they contemplate violent crime. For those who find crime fascinating in a grotesque way, The Book of Murder is an illuminating eye-opener. Murphy, assigned to the homicide unit of the Orange County, California Prosecutor's Office, goes into the details of a series of shocking cases he handled. They included a serial rapist murderer who slipped through the cracks of the criminal justice system, the sudden disappearance of a husband and wife who were trying to sell their yacht, the complicated murder case of a successful entrepreneur who invited a cold-hearted gold digger into his life, etc. Murder cases are not limited solely to the courtroom, and the prosecutor isn't the only star of the show. Sometimes long investigations are required from dogged investigators who are part of a larger team who are dedicated to achieving a modicum of justice for the families and friends of murder victims. This book will be an eye-opener for some, a reaffirmation for others. Bad people who do terrible things are out there, and it's the job of people like Murphy and his cohorts to track them down and put them away. Continuing with state news, in healthcare, an article entitled Chicago's Safety Net Hospitals Prep for Beautiful Bill Cuts. Christine Mertzelos is trying to avoid having her leg amputated. Twice a week, a hospital van carries her from her home in Wrigleyville to the wound clinic at Humboldt Park Health, where a diabetic ulcer on her ankle is cleaned, treated, and dressed. At one point, the ulcer wrapped nearly all the way around her lower leg, a situation that can lead to amputation if not controlled. The ulcer, however, has shrunk significantly. "This place has been a lifesaver for me," said Mertzelos, 61. "Without this clinic, I don't know what I would do." She and others, however, are worried that they may have to find out in coming years. The recent signing of the One Big Beautiful Bill has thrown into question the future of services at safety net hospitals like Humboldt Park Health that care for large numbers of people on Medicaid. The new law will slash an estimated $1 trillion from Medicaid over the next 10 years to help pay for tax cuts and enhanced border and national security, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Humboldt Park Health will likely see an additional $5 to $7 million in losses annually once the changes go into effect, said CEO Jose Sanchez. The hospital typically has an operating margin of about $1 million annually. "I came in this morning and met with senior leaders and said, we've got to begin to think about how do we position ourselves to face the potential cuts we'll have," Sanchez said earlier this week. About 75 to 80% of Humboldt Park Health's patients are on Medicaid, and the hospital employs about 1,000 people, he said. "When you absorb the magnitude of those cuts, that means now you are beginning to make a decision of what services you are not going to provide. When you eliminate services, you eliminate people as well. As a state, Illinois stands to lose about $48 billion in federal funding for Medicaid over 10 years, according to KFF, a nonprofit organization focused on health policy. More than 330,000 Illinois residents, or nearly 11% of those now on Medicaid, are at risk of losing their health coverage over the next decade, according to Manat Health, which provides legal and consulting services in healthcare. New work requirements for certain adults on Medicaid don't go into effect until late December 2026, and major changes to provider taxes, a mechanism states use to help fund their Medicaid programs, won't take effect until fiscal year 2028. But hospitals aren't waiting to start making plans. "Undoubtedly, the hospitals can't wait until the policies are fully implemented," said Dr. Ben Summers, a professor of health policy and economics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. "They need to start planning now." Patient Maria Fuentes worries about what will happen if Humboldt Park Health has to cut its offerings. Fuentes has been going to the hospital, which was previously called Norwegian American Hospital, for decades and gave birth to all four of her kids there. "It's my hospital," said Fuentes, 52, of Dunning, as she visited on a recent day for a checkup. Sinai, Chicago, will also face difficult decisions in coming years as the law's provisions take effect. Sinai, which includes Mount Sinai Hospital on the west side and Holy Cross Hospital on the south side, has been running in the red, and about 70% of its patients are on Medicaid, said CEO Dr. Ngozi Ezike. "It's too early to say exactly how much money Sinai will lose as a result of the new law, but going forward there will be services that will have to be adjusted," Ezike said. "There are a lot of things that will have to be looked at, including layoffs, everything that we don't want to do. Those are all things that have to be on the table," Ezike said. Cook County Health also expects to take a hit, including a loss of about $88 million a year, once the work requirements go into effect, with an estimated 10% of its Medicaid patients potentially losing coverage, said CEO Dr. Eric Mikaitis. "Many people are expected to lose Medicaid, not because they don't qualify, but because of increased paperwork-related challenges." Cook County Health isn't planning on any layoffs or service changes for now, as it works through a projected budget gap for 2026, Mikaitis said. "But in coming years, the more that happens, the more likely there may be a time we'll have to make difficult decisions." Mostly, he worries about how the new law will affect patients who may lose their health care coverage. "As people lose coverage, they stop engaging in preventative care, and instead of seeing patients in the office to manage blood pressure and diabetes, we're going to see them in the emergency room to manage strokes and heart attacks," he said. Lurie Children's Hospital also sees potential trouble ahead. About half of Lurie Children's Hospital's patients are on Medicaid. Though those patients are children and won't be subject to work requirements, hospital leaders worry about how other cuts to federal Medicaid dollars for Illinois might affect its offerings. The hospital is already limited by the gap between what Medicaid reimburses for its services and what that care actually costs to provide, said Lurie CEO Dr. Tom Shanley. The question, he said, is, are we going to be able to continue the degree of the services we have today as we move forward? As Mertzelos finished her treatment at Humboldt Park Health on a recent day, she wondered aloud what would happen to people like her if the hospital had to cut its offerings. It literally scares me to hear something like services might be cut because I don't know what I would do, Mertzelos said. Dr. Anne Marie Kulikauskas, who is medical director of the hospital's wound clinic, overheard her. I don't know what we would all do, the doctor replied. Continuing with local interest matters, on the page 2, top of the morning section, Grabbing a Bite with Joey Wright. The pump in Hoopston has been around for several decades, but what was originally simply a tavern has been under the ownership of Kathy Allwart and Jared Allwart for about a decade, with a renewed emphasis on food for its loyal patrons. We're a full-service restaurant, administrator David Weber said. We do lunch specials daily, and that ranges from home-cooked meals to a little bit of experimentation, and then we always have our open menu, which is pretty extensive, honestly. Weber, who started at the pump as a bartender, is quick to credit the Allwarts for their hard work. We're a pretty small community, and man, the amount that they put into this community and how well they run this, Weber said. They are definitely the core of the familial kind of vibe that we end up having here. They're the heart and soul of it. The pump's close-knit staff is a big part of the restaurant's success, with a key role in choosing dishes and crafting cocktails based on customer feedback. Our staff is definitely like family, and we cater to a lot of families, Weber said. We try to include everyone. The kitchen staff, the thing I love about them the most is that they prioritize fresh homemade ingredients as much as possible. We like to experiment and have a little fun. Also on page 2, the This Day in History column. In 1925, gasoline prices went up 1 cent a gallon at Standard Oil stations in Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Kansas, and North and South Dakota. In Illinois, the price to the consumer increased to 21 cents a gallon. In 1975, Governor Dan Walker announced $49.7 million in cuts for higher education, including a cut of $12,260,000 from the University of Illinois budget. In 2010, local taxing districts now stand to receive only a sliver of the $8.8 million Provena Covenant Medical Center paid Champaign County last week in back taxes. Urbana officials say most of the money will be held in escrow until legal issues surrounding the tax payments and Covenant's taxable status for several prior years are resolved. In international history, on July 14, 1789, in an event symbolizing the start of the French Revolution, citizens of Paris stormed the Bastille prison and released the 7 prisoners held there. On this date in 1798, Congress passed the Sedition Act, making it a federal crime to publish false, scandalous, or malicious writing about the United States government. In 1881, outlaw William H. Bonney Jr., alias Billy the Kid, was shot and killed by Sheriff Pat Garrett in Fort Sumner in present-day New Mexico. In 1912, American folk singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie was born on this day in Okama, Oklahoma. In 1933, all German political parties except the Nazi Party were outlawed by the government of Nazi Germany. In 1945, Italy formally declared war on Japan, its former Axis partner during World War II. In 1960, 26-year-old Jane Goodall first arrived at the Gombe Stream Reserve in present-day Tanzania to begin her study of the wild chimpanzees living there. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Monday, July 14, 2025 edition of the News Gazette.